from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Is the past prologue? Do historians agree that the past is in fact recognizable? How does history's changing landscape affect the historian's view of the future? Soundings now addresses those questions by way of the following separate discussions with two scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center: Timothy Breen of Northwestern University and Franklin Ford of Harvard University. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Timothy Breen about his forthcoming History of Colonial America. Following that, a discussion with Franklin Ford about how professional historians view not only the past, but the future. Timothy Breen is now at work on Volume 1 in the Oxford History of the United States.
I have decided that one of the great problems that has impeded writing this kind of narrative history was the myth of the colonial period, I call it. And that is that something, that there was a unified experience before the Revolution. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would go further and say that the American Revolution is the bane of the colonial historian's existence. And I think if you think even for a second, you'll see why. It's all too easy to see all of colonial history as leading to the American Revolution, as somehow a prologue or a rehearsal for revolution.
Even a cause. Right.
And of course, most people, most of the time, weren't thinking of revolution, were loyal English men and women, or didn't give the problem any thought at all. The revolution didn't become a possibility until the 1760s. So I have decided to look at the colonial period, sounds a little cliché-ish, but on its own terms, mm-hmm. to try to see how men and women would have perceived their lives and their institutions within the context of belief patterns and material culture of the time. I see the 17th century, the initial colonization, as a rather discrete and independent period. I'm going to divide the colonial period into two separate segments. And the first would be, the 17th century, or what I sometimes call the short 17th century, which runs up to roughly the 1690. I'll come back to why that's a date. But in that early period, we find men and women migrating largely from England. Of course, there were some French and there were Africans, but largely an English migration to different parts of the Atlantic seaboard. They were not always aware of each other's coming. They came for different reasons. Some came for religious reasons. Some came because they didn't want to get drafted. Some came because they were poor. Some came because they were noblemen looking for a nice opportunity.
So it's hopeless to try to just give them a blanket reason for having come to America.
Right. There's no... But what we see is almost a fragmentation, as if you had taken a vase and shattered it, mm-hmm. and little pieces landed in the fragments of English society. Oftentimes, their greatest loyalty was not to some nation of England, but to an area, the West Country, East mm-hmm. Anglia, Yorkshiremen. And this is how they saw themselves. And so the colonies and the colonists were most different from each other, and in some ways most un-English, in the 17th century. As you know from your study of literature, Wayne, there's always a great question about Americanization. When were the first Americans?
When did it become American literature?
Right. In the 17th century, you could argue that Americans were most American because they were given the freedom and the isolation of little districts to develop at their own pace in their own ways.
Now, that's what you're going to argue.
Right. Uh-huh. Now, the 18th century, and I'll say if the 17th century is the short 17th century, the 18th century is the long 18th century, because it starts around 1690 and goes far beyond, I would say, all the way up to 1820, but mm-hmm. fortunately I don't have to do that. The reason we take the 1690 as a break is, on the political level, there was something called the Glorious Revolution in England, in which the Stuart kings were made to become constitutional monarchs. This is the time when William and Mary come from Holland and take over the, mm-hmm. the throne of England, and there's a rule of rule of law that the earlier Stuarts had not observed. But also it's a time of demographic transformation, as I've indicated earlier. This is a time when people who in earlier years would have died are now sustaining themselves, forming families. It is in the 1690s, for instance, is the first time in Maryland and in Virginia where more people in the legislature were born, they're native-born, than they are immigrants. Before that, the immigrants always outnumbered the native-born. They just weren't
made. It had taken almost a whole century for that to happen.
Yeah, certainly in those southern colonies.
Yeah.
Well, what happens in the 18th century are a number of elements that the colonists have what I would call common experiences, although they weren't aware of it. On one level, trade increased as the population grew. The 18th century was probably the greatest period of American population growth. They really took the Lord's request to go forth and multiply with a kind of a seriousness, and the population what became the United States just absolutely rose phenomenally. What this meant, of course, among other things, is you have more producers of goods that can be traded. You also have more consumers. And throughout the Atlantic colonies, you find a greater desire for trade. And they are importing at record levels manufactured English goods.
Well, let me ask you a really large question, Tim. Where, if you had to use a word or a phrase to sort of sum up the national identity or the character, is it something as simple as just money, the way we use money, the way we treat goods in a unifying sense, insofar as that's what characterizes us as a people?
Well, I think yes. The answer is yes, but you have to go beyond that and
with much qualification.
Read in what I was about, what I would say, and it certainly draws on what you're suggesting, is that not only through this trade, but through the 18th century is also a century of war, the great wars against the French. It's also a century of religious revivalism, something called the Great Awakening in the middle of the century, when preachers would cross colonial boundaries, bringing the word of God. The great preacher Whitfield is an example, but also Jonathan Edwards and others.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is there was a number of elements of life where people were breaking out of the old boundaries and becoming aware of a broader world, but more, they were also becoming aware of being a part of an empire.
Mm-hmm.
Those early colonists were escaping England. They were, in the 17th century, working out their own destinies at their own pace. In the 18th century, colonists are increasingly being drawn into an English world, one of rules, of soldiers, of goods, of threads, of buttons. And so that the 18th century, if I had to give it a label, is a century of Anglicization.
Mm-hmm.
And if the 17th century is the time of Americanization, 18th century is just the opposite. It's a pulling into a European nexus in a way that had never been done before.
In other words, they lived by themselves during the 17th century, and they had an identity simply in the sense that they were separate. Then they came to have what you call an Anglo identity, something to rebel against, in effect.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it?
That's exactly right. It's very well put. And people often say to me when they hear about this interpretation, what about the Germans? What about the Scots-Irish? Mm-hmm. Because these were tremendous migrations in the 18th century. About the Scots-Irish, alas, we don't know enough, but there's some wonderful handbooks that were published for the Germans in the 1740s about how to pass as an Englishman, how to pass as an...
Is that so?
And
the society that calls itself a melting pot.
Right. Now, there are some groups among your listeners, I'm sure that they'll think immediately, some groups clearly didn't become Anglicized, black men and women.
Right.
Now, what is occurring?
American Indians.
American Indians, of course. And what happens to them? How do they fit into my interpretation?
Well, what's the answer?
The American Indians were just simply pushed away.
Yeah.
It was possible to grow up in 18th century Philadelphia or Boston and never see an Indian. But I mean, there's no getting around the story of the American Indians, a very sorry one, and their cultures were largely destroyed through. Now, getting to the blacks, in the 17th century, let's go back to my early period. It was possible in some areas for black people and white people to negotiate very open, and I think historians find surprising relationship. In the 17th century, when black people arrived and died so quickly, as the whites were doing too, it was very difficult to sustain any kind of heritage. Historians go back and they want to find roots and language and survivals from Africa, but frankly, with everybody dying so quickly, you're talking about a demographic catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
In the 18th century, however, black men and women began to not only live, but form large populations. And it is in this period that a rich tapestry of black culture begins to develop, of kinship forms, of Afro-American religion, of a sense of music. It's in the 18th century that the banjo is developed by the black people. What I'm saying, of course, is that my periodization for blacks as well as whites works on a 17th, 18th century basis. It's just that different rhythms are involved in these. You're talking about different race. It becomes the 17th century is a time when people are mixing, experimenting. They're open. There's a kind of a problematic quality of culture. 18th century, much more rigidly divided between black, red, and white. You are what your color is. You are what your social standing.
And we're living with the consequences of that today.
Of course, to some extent, many decisions were made in those times that we still live with.
Tim, let me ask you this: how much you've been talking about your narrative history of colonial America in terms of method and evidence? How much do you worry about the ideas of these times? What you would call intellectual history and the relationship between chronology and interpretation and the importance of ideas in America?
Well, I worry about that problem a great deal. One of the great criticisms of the new social history is that we know what people ate and how many pots and pans they have, but we have lost any sense of the development of liberty.
And what they thought about.
Thought about right. God or whatnot. And I think that is a fair criticism. Certainly since World War II, we have increasingly turned to the history of what some people call the history of everyday life, what people did with their family lives and whatnot. But one of the goals that I will have is to tell my reader about these larger ideological systems. Certainly for the entire colonial period, religion was an extraordinarily important, integrating, informing, consoling force in the lives of these men and women. And there's always a danger when you talk about beef and pigs, that you accidentally secularize the story. I mean, leave the reader the sense of, well, they're kind of like we are, and they have their barbecue or they have their beefsteaks and whatnot. That's not what their world was different than ours.
Their intellectual concerns.
Their intellectual, and those ideas did inform the way they looked at marriage and their own mortality and a number of other things. I would hope, though, that the best scholars would see that I was trying my best to handle the latest interpretations and juggling a whole lot of literature that is of excellent quality, and would appreciate the effort. But we just simply don't know. This book will take, I estimate, another 3 years just simply to research.
Timothy Breen is professor of history and American culture at Northwestern University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, he worked on Volume 1 in the forthcoming Oxford History of the United States. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on History and the Historical Enterprise concludes now with a discussion with another scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. He is Franklin Ford of Harvard University. While at the center, Franklin Ford worked on a project entitled Don't Forget the Future, History and Looking Ahead.
I think the best way for me to begin would be to draw a distinction. It's not a terribly sharp one, but I think basically it's an important one, between studying, if by that one means applying a certain technique like the use of historical sources, that on the one hand, and on the other, having an attitude of interest in the future. I'd rather almost say that one's talking about not a technique at all, but a certain set of mental habits or kinds of awareness.
What do you mean by habits of mind? What kind of a mental attitude are you after?
Let me give you a couple of quick examples of what I would call quite recognizable historical thinking methods that do apply to the future. And mm-hmm. my argument is that we apply them when we talk about the future without even realizing it sometimes. One is well known to historians as the counterfactual hypothesis.
The counterfactual
hypothesis. Yeah. All that means is to imagine a condition contrary to fact insofar as we know the facts.
Uh-huh.
Try to imagine the difference in the Third Reich had there been no Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
What you're doing is subtracting the figure of Hitler and asking what would have happened, what would have been the same anyway because of broader developments in Germany after the First World War and so on, and what did his particular personality bring that changed it? That kind of exercise is iffy.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what it would have been, but it seems to me that when you look ahead and say, if such and such happens, or if such and such a figure appears, you'll get this result, and if not, you'll get a different one. You're doing exactly the same thing.
Well, is this one of the reasons that historians would be scornful of trying to do the future?
My experience is they're less scornful if they're reminded that they do it in talking about the past anyway. Another example would be a problem that every historian deals with all the time, really, which is to try to strike a balance or to decide on emphasis between continuity and change. When I said that we assume that people of the past are recognizable to us, I'm assuming that there's that much continuity.
Mm-hmm.
We also recognize that there are political revolutions and economic revolutions, industrial revolutions separating us, so we assume there's change. The question is always how you strike that balance. Do you really come down finally saying the world may change, but it changes slowly, or do you end up saying the world may change slowly, but it does change? Now, when you look ahead, you're always asking, will people 100 years from now be more like us than different from us in certain respects? And it's up to you to decide which respect you're interested in.
Tell me, Franklin, how much prophecy is involved here? Now, I imagine that historians would be very skeptical about that sort of thing. That isn't what you're talking about, right?
No. And the reason I think historians are rightly suspicious of prophecy, there are really two reasons. One is that it slides very quickly into the question of precise prediction.
Mm-hmm.
And everything we know about history suggests that that's extremely difficult, perilous, and intellectually arrogant, because no good historian, I think, believes that there is such a thing as perfect recurrence in history. So that if you tell him something happening in foreign policy is Munich all over again, or mm-hmm. Vietnam all over again, he becomes suspicious because he knows whatever it isn't that exactly all over again.
Well, why? Let's just pause on that for a moment. Why don't the historians step forward then and say to the journalists or to the interpreters of events, you ought not to use that kind of language? If we're talking about drawing, for instance, parallels between what's going on in Central America and Vietnam, or what's going on in any situation and Munich or World War II, if that's so risky.
Well, the simplest answer would be that nobody will pay attention very long, because that is rhetorically such a yeah. helpful device, not only for politicians, but even sometimes for historians when they get into an argument, that uh-huh. they'll go ahead and use it. The other reason, I think, is that you can overstate that position to a point where you say that the experience of the past is irrelevant, mm-hmm. and no historian is any good is going to be caught out saying that. All I'm saying is, an answer to your question about prophecy, is that for that reason, that you don't want to get mixed up with notions of exact prediction,
mm-hmm.
and also because the whole idea of prophecy and a kind of messianic future of the future is one thing that modern historians have been brought up in resistance to.
Can involve moralizing, for instance.
It can, or it can involve totally unhistorical interventions, providential. Mm-hmm. In the case of, St. Augustine assumed that you didn't have to worry much about the future, because when the Lord decided it was time to close the books, he'd do so.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like James Watt talking about the American West.
Sure. I think that the providential mind is still with us very strongly, and I'm not knocking interest in what the Lord's views are, but I'm trying to explain why professional historians or deeply historical people, whether amateurs or professionals, dislike the term prophecy.
Mm-hmm. Why else would historians be scornful of, now let's get our wording right here, futurologists or historians who examine the future?
Well, I hope we mean just the former.
Okay.
When we talk about historical judgment of a past event, say the problem of assassination, was there a conspiracy around Lee Harvey Oswald or something like that, the historian will normally insist that historical judgment requires him to say the best he can on the basis of the evidence so far available. That's very different from a judicial judgment, which has to be reached on the basis of what can be presented to a jury. Everybody may be just slightly convinced, 51-49, but once the decision's taken, the score is 100-0.
In other
history
words,
is an open-ended judgment.
It's the difference between the empirical and the probable.
That's right. Well, I think historians essentially deal with probability all the time. They have very high probabilities, such as that the Battle of Waterloo occurred, or they have reasonable probability, such as that in one case there was a conspiracy, in another case there wasn't. But notice the historian is assuming that there are still more returns to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, he's already operating in the future, and including the future extension of the time continuum in his judgment of the past.
Franklin, do you have a sense as a historian that that people generally think or worry or are concerned about the future? I mean, we all think about dinner on Saturday night and we're going to get paid in 3 weeks and got to, you know, maybe we're going to travel at Christmas time, that sort of thing. How does the future enter into the popular mindset? Is it a concern at all?
I think I would answer that partly in terms of biology. In a certain sense, biological realism makes some people lean back away from talking about the future. The most cynical answer you can get from somebody is, I'm not going to be there, so why should I care?
Yeah.
The answer to that, in turn, it seems to me, is if you're not curious about the future, you're somewhat unusual, because everybody is curious about the past and nearly everybody is curious about the future. And biology comes back into it. If you say you mean you don't care how your grandchildren will live,
yeah,
then they become immediately interested in the future.
Well, does it take something like, an issue that is on many minds these days, if not all, is the issue of arms control and a bomb, somebody, God forbid, pushing a button and bam, the whole thing goes up. Does it take an issue like that to get people thinking about the future?
On balance, I think I'd have to say that the nuclear threat inhibits more than it encourages thinking about the future.
Because it's a scary thing?
Well, it would be the equivalent of the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the end of the world image of the Middle Ages, for example, inhibited historical thought as long as it was very powerful. That is, if you...
You mean the imminent...
Assume that any Monday morning the whistle might blow,
yeah,
and that
right.
would be it.
It's
very hard to maintain your sense of suspense about the future, except possibly about when that happens. But the trouble with a picture like the kind of nuclear holocaust, chiliastic is the technical term for that, you know, they... dramatic change that leaves everything unrecognizable, maybe everything in rubble.
Say that again.
There is a kind of...
Chiliastic.
Chiliasm is this, it's a millennial notion that some fine year everything will be so changed that what we think now about it won't make the slightest difference.
Mm-hmm.
There are two things wrong with lingering on that too long. One is, if that's true, there's nothing you can do about it. So it's not really arguable. That is really the catastrophic view of history, and it's got to be there, I suppose, in everyone's thinking, but it doesn't do much for your thinking. Specifically, and this is the second reason why I don't indulge in it very much, it inhibits your thinking about everything else. It becomes a kind of cop-out.
Sure, and implicit in what you're saying is that the upshot, the benefit, however you want to characterize it, of looking at the future is what it's going to do to us now.
And thinking about fairly immediate things. For example, one of the sleepers always in historical analysis is trying to tell the difference between manifest cause, a manifest change at any given time, and latent change. Now, those are kind of ponderous words, but I can give you a good example of that. If you look back at the 17th century, it's quite clear that the discovery of the New World was having a lot of effects on Europe, all of which were manifest, but there was a latent one that most people didn't recognize, and that is that it was going to be indirectly important for the conquest of the plague. Because for centuries, a strain of Asiatic infection had been entering Europe and hitting a population that had virtually no defense against it. One of the secondary results of the period of exploration and colonization was that the European population apparently developed defenses against plague, which it hadn't had before. And the result of that, or it was a contributory cause, let's say, to a major result, which was the beginning of the modern population explosion in the 18th century. Now, that's a latent change that nobody at the time could have been expected to see. We see it as very important. My point is that it's interesting to ask, from the future's point of view, what kind of latent changes are going on right now, which are not always the things that we're most excited about.
Let's conclude, Franklin, with your reflections on the notion that people who don't understand the past or people who ignore it are condemned to repeat it. What do you think of that?
That's Santayana's famous statement, and it's a glittering statement. It actually appears in a rather strange context. You put it into two different books, and both times, I think he was being somewhat capricious in his writing, mischievous maybe is a better term. It wasn't a deeply historical judgment. The one that I personally prefer a great deal is Burckhardt's, because it includes the warning about specific prediction with a kind of statement of faith in understanding the past to look ahead. And it, in his in his historical reflections in the middle of the 19th century, Burckhardt, the great German-Swiss historian, says what we ask of experience, he uses the term experience, not history, but he could have said what we ask of history is not that it make us cleverer the next time, but that it make us wiser forever.
Franklin Ford is a professor of history at Harvard University. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a forthcoming study entitled Don't Forget the Future, History and Looking Ahead. Franklin Ford's most recent book is Murder and Politics, From Tyrannicide to Terrorism. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on History and the Historical Enterprise, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about science and gender. My guests will be Elizabeth Fee of Johns Hopkins University and Ruth Hubbard of Harvard University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for a discussion about history and the historical enterprise. Is the past prologue? Do historians, in fact, agree that the past is recognizable? How does history's changing landscape affect the historian's view of the future? Some answers and insights from two scholars at the National Humanities Center. Timothy Breen of Northwestern University and Franklin Ford of Harvard University. Past as Prologue, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.